Myanmar's military regime, known as the Tetma Dao, seized power in March 2021, and nearly 18 months into their rule, the country continues its descent deeper and deeper into civil war. The regime has cranked up their level of brutality, which in recent weeks saw the dreadful executions of four democracy activists, which we have discussed previously on the program. Who is exactly running the show, and what are their long-term goals, and what does the future hold for the military? To find out more, we're joined by Associate Professor Jonathan Lillibard from the ANU's Law School. He was born in Burma. He's ended up in Canberra via Sweden and the US, and we welcome him to our little wireless program. A number of activists, of course, were executed a few weeks ago. The world was shocked. Were you surprised?
Not surprised, but it was unexpected. It was surprising in the sense that I think it caught everyone's attention. These were the first executions in Myanmar since 1988. And so it was quite a significant step by the military to take this decision. It was something, though, that in many ways is predictable. Since the months since the military coup, there's been a continuing escalation of force by the military and increasing attempts at the application of violence and intimidation. So I think that this particular escalation to execution was something that people saw coming down the pipeline.
Now, the military, of course, is not monolithic. Take us through the personalities and the factions.
Yeah, so a number of Myanmar observers, and I'm among them, we don't see the military as being a unitary entity. There's different factions inside the military with different interests, and it's a situation where the coup was a product of a number of those factions uniting together. There are the main leadership, so this is the core, the kernel of the coup, and this was the figures Min Aung Hlaing, who's the central figure that I think that most people have seen in the press. But then there were also other members of the inner circle. So U Myint Swe, who was the former vice president and who became president and then stepped aside from Min Aung Hlaing. There was U So Tut, who's the current minister of home affairs. And then U Myat Thun U, who took over or is the current minister of defense. And then there's a Won Aung Lwin, who's the new Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But outside of that cadre, there are elements of the military that are more business-oriented, so that they have amassed quite a bit of personal wealth as well as institutional wealth. A lot of that was driven through transnational trade or business that occurred over the course of the past 10 years. And some of those are very much committed to the military, but then there are other factions within that that actually are more interested in the money-making aspects and so less interested in sort of the military ideology that is driving the ringleaders.
Jonathan, they already had most of what they wanted, even under Aung San's government. Why the coup?
That's correct. And I think this is what has been driving a lot of discussion among a lot of Myanmar observers. The military, as you say, had what they wanted. So what they wanted specifically was they needed a civilian leadership that could provide legitimacy to the state and the instruments of the state. And that would effectively during the past 10 years, it effectively gave the military an umbrella with which they could go ahead and conduct operations, engage in business, increase the personal wealth. And that's exactly what they did. And effectively, it was a situation where Myanmar was becoming a scenario that was comparable to what's occurred in countries like Egypt, in Indonesia in the past, where the military controls the engines of the economy. You know, they control the factories, the hotels, the banks, you know, the tourism businesses, the infrastructure, And in order to do that, they need to maintain good relations with the international sources of trade and financing. And so the civilian government had provided that. And on top of that, the civilian government was also taking the blame for the military actions in places like Rakhine State. So it was Aung San Suu Kyi, for example, that was appearing in the International Court of Justice case regarding the Rohingya. There are suspicions among Myanmar observers that the coup was a product of Min Aung Hlaing's personal ambitions. That
he wanted to be president.
It wasn't enough. He wanted to be president. It was not enough that Aung San Suu Kyi was providing a civilian umbrella or civilian legitimacy for the military's activities, that he personally wanted to take over the position of the presidency. In order for that to happen, he had to remove the National League for Democracy, which is the elected government of Myanmar, and remove Aung San Suu Kyi from her position as the leader of the country.
With her in jail, there must be a new generation of activists and voices coming through.
And indeed there is. And so in the days after the coup, I think most of the world saw through the media that there were widespread street protests comprised primarily of youth. And so this is the Gen Z movement. And the absence of Aung San Suu Kyi has effectively created a vacuum where the younger generations are able to take on greater roles in terms of resistance to the state and the military. And so I think what we're witnessing now is this wave of youth that's starting to take on a greater presence within Myanmar politics. Having said that, though, we're also witnessing a process of transition where there's sort of this discourse or dynamics that's taking place between the youth movement versus more established generations that are leading the pro-democracy resistance. So this is includes the National Unity Government and the committee representing the Pidong Hluttaw, or the CRPH.
Jonathan, the military has its roots back in that original coup in the 1960s.
Yeah, so the Tatmadaw originated with, the founder of the Tatmadaw was General Aung San, the father of Aung San Suu Kyi. And what most of the public does not know or is not aware of was that his training, military training, was under the Japanese Imperial Army. And so if you want to have some sense as to the foundations of the Tatmadaw and for the methods and philosophies that they exercise and their activities, you can trace a lot of that to the practices and mindset of the Japanese Imperial Army during World War II. And that helps to explain a lot of the brutality that is applied by the Myanmar military now.
Are people still signing up for the military?
So the Myanmar military at the moment is having great difficulty finding new recruits. And so as an example of this, what I'll note is that the Defense Services Academy typically gets around 500 applications every year. This past year, for 2022, the application round, they only had 22 applications. And so I see that as being indicative of a lot of public disenchantment with the military and a high level of reluctance to join the military.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the military ignore the advice of Hun Sen from Cambodia. They all ignore the advice of China, and they're getting more violent.
Yeah, so the Myanmar military is exhibiting signs of an increasingly tightening inner circle. It's a situation where, as you say, that they've always been historically reluctant to listen to international advice. However, what we're seeing this time is that not only are they becoming increasingly isolated, but they're also becoming they're escalating the level of force that they're using. The concern here, and this is something that the audience should take note of for the future, is that history shows that the tighter an inner circle becomes, the more the inner circle closes, the more disconnected they become from reality. And as a result of that, the more likely they are to make decisions that you or I might consider to be irrational.
Well, you make the interesting point that something similar happened to the Nazi Party at the end of the Second World War, and of course to Stalin in his final days.
Exactly. And this is, it's a situation that historians have sort of described as this cult mindset that in the final stages, I mean, everything, you know, it's a regime looks solid until it's no longer solid. A regime looks strong until it's no longer strong. And there comes a point when the inner circle becomes so disconnected from the larger world that they basically just implodes on its own.
I suddenly remember the last moments of Ceausescu, which also illustrates your point.
Exactly. You know, and so the major concern, though, is like how many people have to suffer on, you know, when they finally fall. And that's the big question, I think, that everyone's going to have to think about as we go forward in the case of Myanmar.
Now, there are 55 million people there, twice the size of Australia in terms of population. And it was getting a lot of foreign investment, high risk, but high potential. And now you describe it as a slow motion train wreck.
Yeah, it's a situation right now where you see that between the Tatmadaw versus pro-democracy forces, there's no clear position of superiority in terms of being able to bring a decisive and expedited conclusion. Instead, what we're witnessing is a situation where they're relatively evenly matched, and it's taking a very slow process to have attrition between the two sides. But having said that, to those of us who have been following the situation in Myanmar, the actions of the Tatmadaw, particularly with the executions that occurred recently and the increasing trends that have been happening with respect to the military struggles around the country, point to the fact that it's weakening and it's in a very slow decline.
Where's it heading?
I'm part of the group of scholars that believes that the Myanmar military is losing its grip on power, that the Myanmar military of 2022 is very different than the Myanmar military of 1988. So I'll just reference here, just for the sake of the audience, that, the names like Anthony Davis, Joshua Karlanczyk, and Bertil Lintner, who've published reports on this already, that there's a situation where the Myanmar military of 2022 is comprised of ranks that have had much greater exposure to the outside world over the course of the past 10 years, that were much more interested in a liberal Myanmar. And I mean liberal in the sense of having free engagement with the international community. And this is a stark contrast to 1988. Also, the Myanmar military of 2022 has become much more afflicted by a cadre that's focused on business and monetary revenues. And this is another contrast from 1988. In addition, the Myanmar military of 2022 is facing a population that is much more reluctant to support the military or to join the military, which is another contrast to 1988.
Well, they're running the country off a cliff economically. You were describing a boom time, and that's now well and truly over. Thank you very much for coming on and briefing us. Most grateful to Associate Professor Jonathan Lilleblatt from the ANU Law School.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.